On this Wednesday night, to the streets, massive crowds on the move in Baltimore again. Police at the ready with another night of mandatory curfew ahead. As Major League ball players are forced to play to an empty stadium, no fans allowed. Shockwaves on Everest. Richard Engel reaches base camp where so many remain reeling from tragedy. Tonight, what happened when the mountain started shaking and where the search for the missing stands. Cockpit scare. A drone comes dangerously close to a commercial plane coming in for landing, a police hunt in the air to find it and whoever was at the controls. And tracking your every move, a consumer alert for tens of millions of smartphone users, something you may not know about the Apple or Android device that never leaves your side. Nightly News begins right now.
From NBC News World Headquarters in New York, this is NBC Nightly News. Reporting tonight, Lester Holt.
Good evening in Baltimore at this hour. Protesters are on the move again. Police keeping a very close eye on marchers in the streets as they prepare to enforce another night of mandatory curfew there. We have been watching as a growing crowd of peaceful marchers have made their way to Baltimore's train station, then on to City Hall with a large police presence awaiting them. They're demanding accountability for the death of Freddie Gray, who suffered fatal injuries while in police custody. Let's get right to the streets. NBC's Ron Allen is in the crowd. Ron?
We are in the middle of a huge crowd of young people who've been marching from the heart of Baltimore's Penn Station. They're heading in that direction to City Hall. This is one of several marches that's been going on all day in support of Freddie Gray's family demanding justice. You hear the chants that we heard so loudly and eloquently in Ferguson, Missouri. No justice, no peace, so on and so forth. Can I ask you, why are you out here?
Because we want freedom. They need to stop killing young black men and women. We need to be out here every day pressuring them to make sure they do an investigation. And the police can't investigate themselves.
This is about more than Freddie Gray.
This is about more than Freddie Gray. This is about educational, social, environmental decadence that has plagued the city for eons that no one wants to address.
Crowd stretches back in that direction. Mostly young people, look like university age people. Some are from Baltimore, some are from out of town, and they're marching, and you hear their demands. They're not satisfied. They don't believe that the justice system is going to work for them. They're out here. They're going to stay out here until they see justice. Back to you, Lester.
All right, Ron Allen with the marchers. Let's go to Peter Alexander now. He's at City Hall in Baltimore, where the National Guard is out in force. Peter?
Lester, good evening to you. You can see that strong show of force right now. State and local police, as well as members of the National Guard here. This is the most law enforcement we've seen at this site all week. They've been anticipating these loud demonstrations, and finally they've arrived.
The demonstrations resumed today, hundreds marching through the streets of West Baltimore peacefully as police kept watch.
People are picking up bags and brooms and cleaning up. Parents are keeping kids at home and off the streets. And community leaders have been urging people to head home before the curfew. Oh, yeah.
At Camden Yards today, the best seat in the house was on the outside looking in, fans forced to watch through the gates.
Let's go, O's!
In a sport that celebrates its statistics, a whole new category, games unattended by fans.
While the hits here echoed across nearly 46,000 empty seats, this image may echo much farther. Life in Baltimore is hardly back to normal. These scenes from outside last weekend's Orioles game show tensions were already high. Then a week of violent protests convinced the team to postpone two games and play today to a closed house, citing concerns about taxing the city's resources.
It's sad. It's just a baseball game. This part of it is not tragic. It's the part on the other side of town that's tragic.
John Hawkins needs baseball back, too. He's a concessions manager at the stadium.
You're losing out probably like $350.
This week?
Yeah.
We need this game to be played, but we need the city to be healed first.
Not far from the ballpark at Troy Statton's barbershop, customers say it makes little difference to them. Most can't afford tickets.
Can you imagine how frustrating it is to stand back and watch people go to the Oriole games all the time? So maybe it's apropos nobody's there today.
While Baltimore schools reopened today for 85,000 students, police and National Guard remained on alert, but were not facing off with protesters. Last night's curfew kept most off the streets, but there were limited confrontations and arrests. T. today, music replaced the mayhem. Baltimore Symphony Orchestra with an outdoor concert to help soothe their city. And the curfew here goes back into effect tonight at 10 o'clock. And many people in this community were anticipating Baltimore police to publicly release its results to the investigation into Freddie Gray's death this Friday. But late today, the department said that that's not going to happen, that they're going to hand their investigation over to the state attorney's office to, in their words, protect the investigation's integrity. Lester?
All right, Peter, and police in Baltimore are hardly the only department under the microscope after a series of violent encounters with officers in recent months has provoked outrage and anger from coast to coast. Against that backdrop, a number of police officers and sergeants from around the country have come together tonight for an extraordinary conversation with NBC national correspondent Kate Snow about what it's like to put on the badge and go on patrol day in and day out in a climate of mistrust.
If you had to use one word right now to describe the relationship between the public and the police force,
I would say skeptical.
I'd say strained.
Strained.
Misunderstood.
People are looking at us a whole lot closer today than they were before.
You all see what happens when these incidents get put on television. Does it make you reluctant to pull your weapons sometimes?
No.
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 Not at all.
No.
People have to know that. No officer that I know that I've talked to over 20 years once wakes up in the morning, wants to shoot an unarmed black teen or anybody for that matter. We have kids, we can relate, but our job is as unpredictable as humanity is.
They worry about the rush to judgment after a cell phone video comes out.
Well, through social media, they're acting as the judge, the jury, the executioner without having any of the information or letting the investigation take its course.
Are you all in favor of body cameras?
Yes.
I am.
Yep.
Because it shows everything.
And it'll show our side of it.
This is a tricky question to ask, but do you feel judged because of your skin color sometimes?
No more than anybody else. And I don't know if anybody else wants to comment on that, but some black officers in our department tell me they have bigger issues going into some of these communities because
exactly.
They're labeled as betrayers.
He hit the nail right on the head. When we go out to the incidents where a male black, female black is the suspect or they've been shot, we take the brunt of that from our own society. You know, I've been called everything from traitor, Uncle Tom.
What do you do to defuse that?
Most times I just ignore it because a lot of times I realize it's because they're angry that they're lashing out at me.
Back up! Back up!
What would you say to the angry voices out there?
Channel your anger. Channel it. Channel it for something positive. Help us. Help us help you.
NBC's Kate Snow with important perspective from people doing a tough job. Turning overseas now to the devastating earthquake in Nepal and stunning new images just now surfacing, including this security camera video capturing the shocking moment the quake hit. Terrified people with nowhere to run as a building collapses into the street. And these photos of a baby boy pulled from the rubble after 22 hours, alive and remarkably uninjured. Now, 4 days after the quake, hope is fading that more survivors will be found under all this wreckage. But the search continues. The earthquake shook even Mount Everest itself, triggering a massive avalanche that killed at least 18 climbers. Today, our chief foreign correspondent, Richard Engel, became one of the first journalists to reach Everest and has our report.
Through the window of a rescue helicopter, we finally saw it.
And that is Everest.
The tallest mountain in the world and the site of last weekend's deadly avalanche. Most died here.
This is the Everest base camp. The avalanche came down from here. The snow and rock came crashing down, destroying all of this part of the base camp, and they are still looking for bodies.
Hundreds of climbers remain in what's left of the long and narrow tent city, the storied staging ground for the ascent of Everest. Climbed because it's there.
We decided to go up to Camp 1 at 2 o'clock in the morning.
Dan Mazur from Olympia, Washington, was leading his group up the mountain. But one man chose to stay behind, American documentary filmmaker Tom Taplin.
We tried to convince him to come with us. We worked really hard.
Mazur says Taplin was worried about leaving the safety of base camp.
Everything started shaking. The mountain was falling down all around us. We got a radio call from base camp, our staff, that said base camp had been wiped out, and we couldn't find our friend. And like an hour later, they found his body.
He was one of at least 18 killed at base camp. Many others were injured, but most survived, thanks in part to the extraordinary efforts of this Swiss pilot, Reto Rush. Bad weather had grounded every other rescue helicopter in the area. Rush was on his own, transporting victims to an aid station miles and mountains away.
How many times did you go back and forth?
39, 40 times back and forth.
He shuttled the seriously injured to safety, all 73 of them. Base camp is slowly emptying out. There will be no climbing season this year.
If the mountain doesn't want you to be here, you shouldn't be here. You have to respect it.
Most at base camp now want to walk down out of respect for the mountain and those who died here. Richard Engel, NBC News, Everest Base Camp.
Now, an alarming moment in the skies over Dallas when pilots spotted a flying object coming way too close for comfort and realized it was a drone. All it would take is a collision with an engine or a window, and a drone could cause a major disaster in the air. NBC's Hallie Jackson has this report.
It's a dangerously close call.
Some sort of a lighted drone just flew right over it.
An Airbus landing in Dallas from New York Tuesday night, narrowly missing a drone inside controlled airspace.
And it was a lighted drone.
What appeared to be maybe just 100, 200 feet above us.
The Virgin America flight was on its final mile and a half approach to the runway at Love Field, 600 feet above the ground. That's when the FAA says pilots noticed the drone lit with red and green lights below the plane. They watched as it climbed straight up, passing a couple hundred feet above their plane, immediately notifying air traffic control.
Airbus reported a drone passing over the top of them right around your present position.
Dallas police launched a search for the quadcopter, tweeting a picture from the air and a plea, use drones responsibly.
If they end up colliding with an airliner, it's going to be similar to a bird strike or potentially worse, and it could do significant damage to the airplane or an engine.
It's illegal for drones to fly above 400 feet or within 5 miles of an airport, but that's happening more often and at major hubs like L.A., Chicago, and Atlanta.
It raises questions about, for another pilot seeing such an aircraft, of what's it going to do.
It's why the FAA is working to teach drone operators the rules to keep the skies safe. Hallie Jackson, NBC News, Los Angeles.
A historic moment in Washington today, the first time a Japanese leader has addressed a joint meeting of Congress. Prime Minister Shinzo Abe offered condolences for the Americans killed in World War II, but he did not explicitly apologize for Japan's atrocities during that war, as 25 members of the House had requested in a letter last week. A lot more news still ahead on a busy Wednesday night. Coming up, what your cell phone knows about you. Shocked reactions when we showed people how their smartphones are tracking exactly where they go and keeping a record, including dates and times. How you can turn it off. We're back now with a consumer alert for millions of smartphone users. Technology in your phone that knows exactly where you are at all times, tracking everywhere you go and keeping a record of it. NBC News investigative correspondent Jeff Rawson with what you should know.
It is the motherlode of personal information stored right on your phone for anyone to see.
Oh, my goodness.
On the 5th, you were there from 7:18 a.m. to 9:24 a.m.
Holy cow.
Where you live, where you work. See all those little blue dots? It even maps out where you go, including the date and exact times you were there. On the iPhone, that personal tracker is buried deep. Go to Privacy, Location Services, System Services. Scroll down even more, and there it is, Frequent Locations. Tech expert Jim Stickley says on Android devices, all your tracking data is sent straight to Google.
It knows exactly where I was. This morning knows where I was sleeping, how long I slept for, when I left, when I arrived here, and that it knows right now, here's where I'm sitting.
And I don't need your phone for this.
I can look at this, right, if I have access to your account.
You could be any computer anywhere in the world and pull this up.
We showed this group of new moms in the park.
I'm at home alone with my son all the time. I don't want anybody to know where I live.
So you're saying I could take my husband's phone and look at all the places that he's been recently?
Yes.
So maybe I won't tell him how to turn it off.
Apple says they use the information to provide personalized services, and it's kept solely on your device and won't be sent to Apple without your consent. Apple wouldn't tell us if they take the data or not. Google, the maker of Android, telling us users have the ability to enable or disable location capabilities both on their Android device and Google account. Okay, so how do you shut the function off on your phone? Let's take you through it step by step, starting with an Android device. From the home screen, hit Apps, then Settings, scroll down to Privacy and Safety, then hit Location, then right there, Google Location History, hit that, and then just slide it to off. On the iPhone, it's a little different. We're going to walk you through that as well. From the home screen, hit Settings, scroll down to Privacy, Location Services, scroll down again, told you it's buried deep, to System Services, scroll down again, and there it is, Frequent Locations, and slide that to off. By the way, there are several different models of Android devices. The instructions vary slightly from model to model. Here's the good news on both Androids and iPhones. Even if you shut off this particular function, your other location services like maps and traffic routing, stuff we use every day, will still work.
Jeff, thanks. You said a lot of us scrambling today with our phones. We know it was a lot to take in. If you didn't catch it all, don't worry. We've posted all the instructions on our Facebook page. You can find it there right now. And we're back in a moment with a dramatic day of testimony in a trial that has gripped the nation. In Colorado today, gut-wrenching testimony in the movie theater massacre trial. James Holmes, accused of going on an unthinkable killing spree 3 years ago, has pleaded not guilty by reason of insanity. Today we heard about the youngest victim, and NBC's Jacob Rascone was in the courtroom.
Veronica Mosier will always be 6 years old, recently graduated from kindergarten, one of many children inside Theater 9 that night.
My two cousins.
Veronica's teenage cousin called 911.
Can you hear me, ma'am?
Veronica had been shot. Her mother, Ashley, was also injured.
I had my hand on her stomach to see if she was breathing, and she was. So I kept telling Ashley that Veronica was okay.
Panicked moviegoers sprinted out as officers rushed in. Officer Michael Hawkins noticed Veronica almost immediately.
I picked her up and I ran out of the front entrance of the theater. I looked down at her and I realized that she was probably gone.
One by one, the prosecution will ask survivors and first responders to relive that night.
If my cane is the weapon, I can see him with the gun holstered up to his chest and he was pointing down to the ground, looking for other people.
The shooter, James Holmes, sat practically motionless in court, staring straight ahead, not speaking. In video evidence, a psychiatrist asks him about those he wounded.
They're like collateral damage, I guess.
Ashley Mosier would survive but never walk again. And her daughter, Veronica, the youngest of 12 victims, gunned down during a night at the movies. Jacob Rascone, NBC News, Centennial, Colorado.
When we come back here in a moment, a teacher worried her harrowing ordeal would make her unrecognizable to her students and the people who helped ease her fears. Finally, tonight, a story about women who find themselves in the battle of their lives and the people on a mission to give them back the confidence they need to go about their daily activities, even when they feel that they're most vulnerable. Here's NBC's Kevin Tibbles with tonight's Making a Difference.
Miss Lauren's Chicago preschool class is a happy place.
Hello, hello, hello.
And 33-year-old Lauren Smoke, pregnant with her first child, wants to keep it that way, despite the fact she's been diagnosed with breast cancer.
One of the first things I worried about was, how am I going to be able to go to work and see these kids and do what I love?
Good time.
When she lost her hair to chemotherapy, would they recognize her or be frightened? Would she feel too uncomfortable to go out? When Lolly Toll lost her hair, her daughters noticed just how therapeutic something as simple as a wig could be.
It meant that she could feel like her and feel beautiful and feel like the conversation was not always about her cancer and that she didn't get pity eyes when we went out.
So when Lolly passed in 2012, Lolly's Locks was created to ensure women would have access to quality wigs that often run into the thousands of dollars.
Thanks to all of you for the beautiful wig you sent me.
So far, more than 300 have been provided free of charge to women across the country.
This could be it, huh?
Yeah.
As she prepares to start her chemo, Lauren is fitted for her new her.
That's half the battle, isn't it? Feeling good about yourself?
I think so. I think if I can feel good about myself, then it makes me think about the bad stuff a little bit less.
Helping women to face the world and the battle with newfound confidence. Kevin Tibbles, NBC News, Chicago.
That will do it for us on this Wednesday night. I'm Lester Holt. For all of us at NBC News, thank you for watching and good night.